Okay, so that was, excuse me, that was the newest from Fievel is Glock. So, and that track is As Above, So Below. Before that, Flying Lotus with Garmin Bosia. Before that, Gia Margaret with Hanuki Wood. And we started off the set with the newest from The Men, and that was Pony. And I will listen to that a few more times to see if I get into it. Like I said, I saw The Men years ago. If you don't know their album, I think it's called Open Your Heart. At least that track is on that album. It came out about 10 years ago. And it's just a great just rock album. It's just really good. And that wraps up this week's show. Stay tuned for Courts in Session. Tune in next week for more new music. And have a great week, everybody.
My big sister Jenna's face turned bright red. She was just showing people online how to use a new cream. She still has the scars.
Real products are tested for safety. My brother's friend Billy had to jump off his motor scooter when it caught fire. He fell and got hit by a car. Blew his chances to play basketball in college.
Go for real.
Visit ncpc.org/goforreal.
Brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council and the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
You are listening to 88.3 FM
WRCT.org, WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, and thank you. Thank you very much for coming out. I just had drops in my eyes, so I'm not seeing you very well. And I'm not sure I can read very well, but I'm going to try. I want part of this evening, small part, to be a simple introduction to what I'm doing at this moment. And I want to share that. And it's important for me to always do that each time I find myself in this kind of situation. I love to share the stuff that's still alive and still coming out. Now, Slave Road ain't old. Get your copy and read it. But this is even younger than the book Slave Road. Mm. And it's not going to take me long to read it. I'll just indulge myself for a few moments. I see my daughter out there. She's not cringing. So, or maybe that was a cringe, or maybe she's smiling. But I'm going to indulge myself just a little bit with a small piece, and then Eddie and I will be in conversation. If I stop in the middle, it means the drops won. And thank you all for coming out again. Black hole. Tattletale tit. Your tongue shall be split, and every dog in the town shall have a little bit. They named the holes they recently discovered in space after me. Same word they had deemed appropriate centuries ago to name me. A word they had invented once upon a time to describe the presence of absolute darkness. Darkness, impenetrable, utter, irremediable, and thus threatening. An absolute absence of light, reminding them of unsettling, unfinished business, of unknowable holes in creation they had to deal with. A useful word way back then and still useful now, though no doubt they would prefer to believe no holes in space their God had allotted for them, his chosen creatures, to occupy and rule. Both namings, then and now, fearful. Unnameable fears that language and the word black may permit the namer to avoid temporarily, but not dispel. Darkness in the heart of a word, in the broken heart of languages spoken to say the word. Silent black darkness because no one's listening. No one hears, nothing there but a word's emptied, shivering presence. the unnameable fears of the unknown world, the unnameable fears of the unknown, the word black echoes and confirms. A vast hovering of unaddressed, hungry voices speaking lost languages, unaddressable except by unspeakable clarity, clamor, chaos beyond the power of the word black or any word in any language to either express or quell. No better than a dog in the street who barks and snarls and spits and snaps at other curs hunkering down to feast on bloody bits of the old gossip's tongue. Here I am chewing on the word black as if my life depends upon it, as if naming me has claimed me, as if I am property the namers own and may dispose of as they see fit, as if black both a color and a fate I cannot escape, as if a word stops time, divides space, as if I occupy a space within but separate forever from space inhabited and ruled by those who name me, as if no other choices, no other languages, no other time and space exist for me beyond what others have named. Then along comes AI to empower the namers, underwrite their naming. AI that delivers impartial, logical accounts of the namers' dominance, of how and why they arrive at language and conclusions that are certain and permanent. AI that gets rid of coincidence by overcoming and replacing time's fickleness, time's unpredictability. AI imitates, simulates, and reproduces meticulously, bit by bit, whatever may be occurring inside and outside a person, though so far it cannot achieve a live person's immediate, intimate experience of things, of words that do not begin nor end, of that relentless movement, change, conscious and unconscious, aware and not, of changing, time passing, of encounters, changes that neither start or stop, inconceivable connectivity, infinite, incalculable, for human minds anyway, but maybe not beyond AI's power to calculate. Maybe gathering enough info, data, negates the idea of future, of the unknown, negates the threatening darkness of those infinite futures, eternally present in the present tense of any living creature. That living presence that represents all possibilities and confirms what has come and will come as one and the same always, as something to survive, to endure, to witness as time, is one compelling attraction of AI, same attraction exerted by the power to name and divide and dominate, the possibility of overcoming time by establishing and confirming an alternative to time's inaccessible dimension, to time's mysterious action forever at work, invisibly governing always. Time that is the presence of what has been and still to be. Time as inevitable forfeiture of one moment of being for another. Is AI an accurate tracker of what must come next? Or does AI's dividing and quantifying of all it surveys perhaps embody wishful thinking that if the correct questions asked, a mode of being separate from time, impervious to time, exists? Or perhaps AI insists that no questions exist. If all questions answerable by AI, wouldn't questioning become obsolete, answers redundant? except infinity encloses each of us, and enforces uniqueness. Each person as absolutely unique as the tiniest prison cell imaginable. Terminal. And there you are. You, yourself, and no one else inside there. No room, nothing inside except the crowds of you passing through an unfillable space. A shadow there and not. Though it may be, it must be yours. You, because who else? Consciousness of being conscious, consciousness of self, impossible without a self. Can AI be conscious of its presence in time as it adds and subtracts? Yes, no, plus, minus, with no stake, life in what it's counting. Scorekeeper of a game it never sees, never cheers or mourns, never plays. No matter how accurate or wondrous or irrelevant the results it announces. What it counts, only the brutal functioning of a machine's sensitivity, of machine receptivity, of questions and answers delivered within a void, bereft of life. AI counts how many cells comprise a person's body, how many subatomic particles comprise a cell, a galaxy. AI can't count how many galaxies in a universe of galaxies only one particular person is able to imagine. Galaxies comprising the singular space that one person or another inhabits alone. Time and space, black and white, male and female, alive and dead, are invented words disguised as facts of a known world. Black and white, no less than the words time and space, serve as arbitrary markers that pose solutions of unresolvable contradictions. Words elicited by discovery of mysterious holes. The word black, like all words, all languages, attempting to separate, to secure the namers from what they name, free them from darkness of unknowable, undivisible worlds. Any known world hides. And so, after much struggle, squabbling, defeat, have I reached a point where I can settle back on my haunches and swallow a bloody morsel I've scavenged? My take, what I am, what I've come to, claimed and conquered with my thoughts, experiences, words, good intentions, teeth, claws, my sense of what's right and wrong about this floundering place I'm floundering around in, this piece of writing I would resolve, if I could, into something other than snarling and snapping, biting other scavengers, me baying at the moon, feeling sorry for myself because nothing my writing contains hurts me or you the way that hurt in the word black hurts, maims, steals, shames, subdues, silences, etc., etc., time out of mind, forever and today. You hear me, don't you? Don't you? Don't you? Don't you all hear the neck bone snap when the entire weight of a body plummets to the end of a lynch rope? Hear skin ignited, burning, smoldering after a child confined to a government desk, government school, government color, government words, and gets cracked across the face by a government nun's backhand for uttering, for exposing the red native tongue inside red cheeks, black cheeks, yellow cheeks, groaning, smoldering, shuddering still, if you're listening, tattletale tit, your tongue shall be split.
Thank you for sharing that. I have thought of at least 1,000 ways to begin this conversation, because I have more than 1,000 questions to ask. But given what you just read, I think I want to ask this one. How are you?
Well, for an old fella, I feel great. And I think each one of you should feel great. However you've hobbled to get here or scuffled to get here, here we are. And we're doing it again. We love to read and write, and we can do it. And for a moment, it's something special.
That's great to hear. Now, what do you see? We're in a moment. You've lived all these years. You've gifted us an extraordinary body of work. You've offered us a Weidman-esque a kind of reflection on words, how they can arrest, how can they can open, how can they become cages in some ways. But here we are, and we have to begin here, it seems to me, where you're writing, reading, and Trump is coming in the White House. And we can't. We could, but we shouldn't think about what we're doing apart from what is about to happen. So what do you see?
What do I
see?
What do I see?
On the immediate horizon, as it were.
I'm very, very concerned. I have grandchildren. And so that time that I was talking about and tried to talk about in the little piece I began with, I see that time already being trod upon, stepped upon, debased. You're a writer. And I think your very accurate notions about the razor's edge that, at best, any democracy, any state, always occupies. But I think, well, let me be more concrete.
Okay.
I have a book, maybe, coming out, not now, but my editors at Scribner's have been looking at the nonfiction work mm-hmm. over the years. And they're probably going to put together a book of essays of nonfiction writing that I've done over the past 50 years, 60 years. And so they've gathered a whole bunch of these pieces for me to look at. And that's a compliment, eh? Drudgery, B, intimidating, C, but it's also scary as hell, because sometimes I make a fool of myself, but sometimes I don't. And as I look back on some of these pieces that go way to 1970, they would be right on this moment. my fears, my angers, the worst things I anticipate in some of those essays are right in my face, in our country's face at this moment. +10, +100. Because what else is in my face, our faces, is nuclear war. And if we can call black, if we can call people either black or white, if we think that human beings are somehow essentially either male or female, if we are foolish enough to hold on to those principles and those ideas, then we might very well push the button. And that's not one regime, not one party or the other, but that's where we all are. We have allowed ourselves to be where we are. It was astounding to me, both looking back at my own writing and seeing how, anything especially precipient, other people have been saying, you've been saying the same things over the years. But as I look now, and I try to see if there's been improvement, if there's been change, I don't see it, Eddie. I don't see it. I avoid watching too much TV. I don't need to be told that cookies talk, and that if I listen to cookies talking, that I'll learn how to live my life, what to eat, what to drink, what to watch, what to wear, who's black, who's white. I don't need cookies dancing on the screen to tell me that. But that's where so much information, quotes, comes from. That kind of juvenile silliness. It just has taken over. And we have elected a new president. And the people who told us and who were in charge of trying to figure out the politics of that election have a chance now to tell us after the fact why it occurred. But I watched. I don't watch much of it because the cookies and the dancing cakes and the, you know, I just can't deal with it too much. But I watched 60 Minutes, and I watched the news, the BBC News, on the educational channel. And in their summaries of what had happened to us, neither said the word white supremacy once. Not one time. Lots of things were said, but that the role of that mental state in the Middle East, Georgia, New York, Kazakhstan, the reality of that word just didn't seem to exist.
And to say that, it's a wonderful transition to Slave Road, what it is, the bodies as you imagine that constitute, right, this space that is traveled between the continent of Africa, that is at the heart of the formation of the modern world, bodies that are upside, you know, belly side up, back on, right, and how you want. It's almost if, and I wanted to say, what is this in some ways? You know, roads have destinations. They don't have endpoints, but they take you someplace in some direction. Does the slave road lead us to here? Does the slave road lead us to what you've just described?
I think there's no other way to get here. I don't think there's a choice. And until that is recognized, until we accept, all of us, accept the responsibility for living a certain kind of life that ignores our history, that ignores how we got here, that we'll do anything, that we'll call it a black hole, that we'll call it a woman's movement or women don't need men movement or any of those explanations which don't go right down to the feet of the person who's thinking them or who's formulating them and identify under their feet the constituent problems and issues, slavery being one, that brought us where we are. If that recognition is not made, we're not. There's only one direction we can go.
Right. So take us. Let's shift gears. Take us to the construction of this book. I mean, it's you know, to talk with you about genre doesn't make sense to me because you're genre busting in so many different ways. Give us a sense of what you set out to do in this text, because I feel like, I mean, people talk about it as autobiography, as nonfiction, as fiction, but there's something else going on here. The way in which you're thinking about language, words, the way in which you're thinking about memory, loss, longing, give us a sense of the process that came to give us this gift, if that makes sense as a question.
Well, I can try to answer. Of course, it's an extremely complicated question, which I would expect from you. You're a demanding person, and that's why you're there. And you know as well as I do that from I'm starting to shadowbox, because they're the recognition that we have gotten ourselves in a world of trouble is either shared or not. And one reason it is not shared is because people don't want to know things about themselves. They don't really want to know. They can't. Maybe it's impossible. So going back, I mean, staying in terms of your question, I'm testing myself. I'm asking myself, where do I stand? And why do I stand where I stand?
Yeah.
And what got me here? I have no cause. I could not justify blaming anyone. But I do know that why I am in this position that I am in has certain antecedents, one of which we could call slavery, and that those are real, that they are so real that they create a kind of highway in time, in space, through dimensions. And so I'm asking myself questions, and trying to ask questions about who I am, where I am, and where it all came from. You know, where did this come from? The sense of connection to horror.
The sense of connection to horror. Oh, my goodness. Where do you come from? Jesus Christ. Thinking about, you know, when I was reading this, you know, I, not only did I go back and reach for Conrad's The Heart of Darkness, I went back and read, you know, I'm always rereading or listening to T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, Time, Present, Time, Future. right? The way in which time passed, the way in which, you know, he moves in that regard. And I was trying to reach for resources in order to hold on in the face of what you were forcing me to confront. The way in which you're vulnerable on the page, there's this moment where you decide that you're going to get up and go jogging. And you describe this in a way that is so powerful in your vulnerability and your hubris. What? Describe that moment for, I don't want to give away the book because you have to get it, right? What are you setting the reader up to understand about you and your searching in that moment? And then, I want to put a pin there, because there's another moment that's much later, when you and your mother visit your brother, and you see a puddle of water underneath the chair, and you don't hold that thought to yourself as a writer. You share it with me, and I cringed. And I was wondering about the connection between that moment and that moment of vulnerability. Help me understand what you want me to understand about you confronting you in those moments. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes too much sense. The book begins with a conversation between myself and my son.
Right.
A truncated conversation. Doesn't go on too long. His mother is dying. And his mother was my wife for 30-some years. And then we were separated for a couple of decades. But there's nothing he can do. He's tending her. I'm completely isolated from that moment. I wish I could help, but I can't. And that's where the hurt and where the grit and the inevitability of loss comes from in the rest of the book. Because that's an autobiographical moment. It happened. I'm documenting it. But neither father nor son can speak very much of it. They have to go back into whatever moment they were in before that phone call was exchanged.
Right.
Words fail. Loss is real. Even if the father could go back, he knows he would have nothing to say to his ex-wife. And he has nothing to say about what happens next in his life.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty dead-end kind of situation. But then I write a book. The book exists. And it goes other places. And you mentioned some of the other places. And it doesn't necessarily get easier. There aren't a lot of solutions or words that just kind of come up and make things better. But the baseline does not change. There's a world that refuses to be controlled. There's a world that asks for our time and our witness, in the sense of religious witness. My grandparents doing witness in the church. Some of them didn't go to church, but that's where the book starts, and it probably doesn't go very much further than that, but it does go further because I needed to write it. I needed to interrogate that moment myself. And whether I do it well or don't do it well, and how, where it takes us, in a way it takes us to the Trump presidency.
Right, right.
But that's one way, one place. I hope that's not the only place. Mm. But I want to
understand, Eddie, where we come from, where we go, and what it costs us.
What it costs us. So the way in which you deal with William Henry Shepherd and Lucy Gantt and Rebecca Proton, what role are they playing? Because you say there's a moment in the text where you say, I have to find my story, right? Find me, right? That moment. Mm-hmm. And there are moments where you're interrogating them, right? There are moments where they and you are interrogating someone else. There are moments where you are imagining them in their last days. Talk a little bit about how that, and you return to them. You actually say this. You actually have this moment in the text, which I love. You say, I dare to read John Edgar Wideman to John Edgar Wideman. Oh, my God. My goal is to revisit and reify moments of my life that haunt and form me, form all of us, saving stories, characters, scenes, and my reactions to them, repurposing, renovating, editing, reordering, fine-tuning to give them another chance, another existence. I claim this privilege because my writing belongs to me. Mm-hmm. But you invite them. Talk a little bit about that.
I feel we all human beings are connected in an extraordinarily intimate and powerful way. And if we are in a bind right now as a nation, if we are maybe on the verge of nuclear war, if we are already participating in wars that are devastatingly bloody and heartless and cruel, I still feel that no matter where you stop, no matter where I would stop, I would find somebody like me. I would find myself. The people in the first row, second row, you don't act like me all the time. I don't act like you all the time. I'm not imitating you. But we have a core of similarity. We have an openness in our little terminal cells, as small as those cells might be. We still can look out the bars and see ourselves free. Huh. We are, each one of us contains every other person. Each person contains the other.
So this historical connection made with this man who enters the Congo at the same time as Conrad, you can enter that space because of that connection?
Well, that's why the slave road persists. Other lives don't disappear. You can kill people. You can slaughter people. You can name them. You can treat people like a black hole. But they don't disappear. Right. You who did it are alive while you're performing that kind of evil on them. And so the evil persists in you. And you will either find a way or not find a way to understand that, to deal with it, to live your life as best you can. But I want my books to keep coming back to that least common denominator, that humanity, that's the only thing I can call it. I don't know about wolves. I don't know about bears. I don't know about the birds and bees, even though I'm supposed to know about that at this age. I can't say. But I do know I find pieces of myself. And when I was a kid, and even much older than a kid, riding the trolleys and buses in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I would look at somebody's my eyes are straight at their shoes. And I'm not talking about looking at a shoe like, nice shoe like you have on, but seeing a really raggedy-ass shoe. Yeah. It didn't matter whether the feet in it were raggedy-ass or not. Didn't matter whether there was a white ankle above the...
raggedy-ass shoe.
You know, for a minute, I was in that shoe. Oh. I was in that shoe. And those moments were as real to me as playing basketball, playing football, as kneeling beside the bed and praying when my mother told me to do that. That shoe, that fact that that was on somebody's foot was as real to me as anything has ever been.
See, I've always, when I've read you, that's really fascinating to hear you. I said I had over 1,000 questions. When I've read you over the years, I've gotten frustrated, especially when you didn't put any periods and stuff, right? I've gotten frustrated, put my stuff, and then of course you forced me to look upon myself. And I've always marveled at your curiosity, right? The what you see and how you look and how your associative mind, the way you can make the connections, just the stuff on the graffiti of Omar, what you do in the text in that moment, right? But what you just described isn't curiosity. It's empathy, but it's a different kind. It's what the German would call it Einfühlen, right? Herder. There's something about this entree into another, standing in another's raggedy-ass shoes. As not a kind of sentimentalist gesture, but something that allows you to bridge the world that has been created as a result of Slave Road, right? To kind of see some connections in this regard. But that's not what I wanted to ask. It just triggered it. Ghost words. I read that phrase and got up and poured myself a stiff Irish whiskey. Ghost words. What are those? Help me. I think I understand. What are those ghost words? Are those the hauntings that you described that nobody is gone forever? Nobody's the dead haunts? What are those ghost words?
Well, I think of...
I'm being very selfish right now. Can you tell? Is this okay? Okay, go ahead.
Ghost words. Well, there's a myth, a very American myth, about a cold winter. And it was so cold that the words froze. And then springtime came. And you're walking along the road, and suddenly you hear a conversation because all of that frozen language falls out, and it sort of gets you. Well, you know, that's a Paul Bunyan story, but it's a great story, and it's how we live. It's how we live, and that's what language is. And I've taught myself to be a writer. I spoke to a bunch of young folk who were studying writing and thinking about writing, and tried to share a little bit about my immersion in writing. But that's what it is for me. That there's no mystery. I wanted to write, and I wanted the writing to teach me about myself and teach me about other people. And so anything that writing does, when it's good, even when it's bad, it's about making that effort to understand something about myself and these strange others who are around me.
Yeah, you have this moment. But if we forget, if we stop, if we hide, if we retreat, if we pretend that the stories we tell, stories telling us, cannot be silenced, that they are immune and will always speak as once we wish them to speak, and that their truth will abide forever, then Joe Wood is gone inextricably, irretrievably gone, because we will have surrendered, because we will have forfeited power we once seized, once expressed power, the power once and once again of words continuing to be spoken, written, invented, danced, emblazoned, carved, moaned, missed, misconstrued, sculpted, damn, sung, new words, old words, words in flight, words struggling to name and naming themselves one more time. There are sentences in this text, in your corpus, that feel, read, sound like a Charlie Parker solo. They just, And you're quoting, there's citations in it, right? There are ways in which you're making chordal combinations. There are repetitions. And the repetition in this, you will literally, I called Imani Perry, texted Imani Perry about this because you use moving 3-4 times in a row in one sentence. And it was like almost back to back to back to back. But it wasn't gimmicky. Talk about, and I was sitting here saying to myself, how old is he again now? What is he? You still have that energy to get to the page, to do what you just read up there with the sentence. Could you talk a little bit about your process to get to that kind of writing? I mean, it's accumulative. I mean, but I'm being a fan now, obviously.
Ego. I never wanted to be a great American writer, even when I was quite young, you know, 16, 20, 25. I didn't want to be a great American writer because I wanted to be greater than American writers.
I love that.
And I was driven by that urge, which ego urge, to try to find language, to try to find a way of expressing things that broke the hegemony, the hegemony, the control of the voices that attempted and were doing a very good job of orchestrating my life and the life of my people. Mm. So always for me, the language was a weapon. And I wanted to learn how to make it dance and sing and wound. And I wanted to make it something that was a kind of escape hatch, a way out of being under somebody else's words, starting with the word black, Negro, boy, poor. And there's a magic in language. We all know that. When we're children, we sing nursery rhymes and we make up words and then we dream.
Yeah.
So there's a magic in words that we all know about. Well, I made it my business in my life to pursue understanding that and expressing that and making that what I was all about.
There's a moment in the text you say two words, life and sentence. Life and sentence. And the way in which you capture the rough and thorny bramble of life, you know, the arc of the text, the slave road that is can be read in, as in some ways felt but abstract. You know, these are bodies we don't know intimately, but the way in which you end, we're right back with loss and longing. Yours. The Penn Station chapter is just fucking brilliant. Right? And is this the daughter who called the train station and got everything right?
Mm.
Okay. she takes credit for the story. You're going to have to read it to figure that out. But loss. And it just piles. At the end, it just... and you've dealt with it before, but I want you to, if you don't mind, what does it mean to grapple with that on the page at this stage in your career? Still.
You know, just one little kind of shift. My chair... Sure. Because there's we're both facing, and your work is as strongly as mine, your writing, horrible, horrible things. But that's not all. Yes, my daughter's out there. Yes, she's out there. One of my sons could be, but he's had to be somewhere else. But another son is in prison. And he is subject to whatever horrors are visited upon him by that prison system and those rules and regulations that supposedly rule him. I just want to emphasize that for me, I consider myself extraordinarily lucky. Number one, I discovered writing. I didn't do that by myself. I had teachers. Then I began to read, and that helped. But also examples, not in books, not in the language that surrounded me on the outside, but the language of home, the language of community. And I've always, there is such joy. There is such a boundless amount of energy and beauty and sharing that was like the padding. However high I went in my own personal life, and I've been very lucky. Rhodes Scholar as a kid, and played basketball at a high level, and did that jogging that you say, even as an old man in Brittany. I could do all those things, and that communal life, those people who nurtured me, and sang to me, and put their hands on me, and walked a certain way that I wanted to walk, and so I imitated it, and danced in a certain way. So that was always the cushion. Mm. So wherever the writing took me in terms of despair, in terms of disaster, slavery, there was that cushion. If my writing means anything, it's a celebration of that cushioning and an attempt to invigorate that and share that with others.
So the horror stands alongside or exists within the joy that is the life that is lived with people with whom we love, folk who love us in spite of us, who enable us to not only dream dreams, but to pursue them. There's this powerful moment in the attic. The lean-to of your sister.
The
attic chapter, the lean-to. Your sister's house. Right? And you're going up, you know, and it's another chapter where we encounter loss. Right? Again. And this image of you walking up these narrow steps into this attic that is populated with tangible things of memories of people who are gone, of lives lived, of experiences had, but you have the hands of the younger ones. Mm-hmm. And I was like, am I feeling in John Edgar Wideman a sense of hope and possibility going up these steps? What were you giving us in that moment?
I was giving you one of my favorite moments. There is an attic in the city of Pittsburgh in my sister's house, and there are steep stairs. You break your ass if you're not careful. And my artifacts, boxes and bags and shopping bags and cleaning bags and...
Yeah.
Are piled there, and I love to enter it.
You love to
love
enter.
To just sit in that space. The moment that you were describing in the book, that part is made up. I didn't have nephews and nieces and walking them up there. That's the magic of writing. I could do that. I could do that without doing it. And you could live it without being there either. But if I didn't have a sister that had the spirit she has, if I didn't have those young people in my family coming up whose hands I want to hold, whom I want to guide, whom I want to see this attic full of relics and things, and if I didn't have imagination and writing, that moment in the book wouldn't exist. And in a way, you might say that if the imagination didn't exist, my sister's attic wouldn't exist.
You are such a treasure. So we have some questions from the audience. Oh, my goodness gracious. You made it up. My Lord. Okay, I need my reading glasses. What do you think? Okay, here we go. What do you think the likelihood is of a mass movement to make a fair face-to-face communication with people on the other side who don't know any Democrats and get all of their information from Fox News?
From?
Fox News. So the cookies and the cakes and the dance, all of that is in a particular ecosystem. What do you think the likelihood is of a moment to make face-to-face communication with people on the other side?
Movement.
Thank you. I don't have my glasses. Go ahead. My reading glasses.
Well, nobody's doomed. Nobody's doomed. And so there's always a chance to turn around. And I believe that. But I don't even understand that question. I guess I don't accept some of the premises.
Right.
I don't think anybody has to watch the ads and listen to the racial and gender nonsense that is epitomized within those ads. I think it's possible to have a good football game without all the bullshit that we have to watch
around it.
Although, as much of a sports fan as I am, I'm about ready to give up. Because for every minute of hoop or minute of football, I got at least 3/4 of a minute of something else. So that's not a really good payoff for me. I'd rather go take a walk if I want to relax
right. My
body and feel strong and maybe even jog, even if I fall. So, you know, people have to make choices. But how do they make choices? How do you teach children that the not to kill?
Ooh.
Wouldn't that be a goal for a school system? It's got to come from there. A group, some generation of young men and women has to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I love Ukraine. I love Gaza. I love Israel. But I'm not going to take a gun or a bomb and go and kill other people. I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah.
You got to give me a different set of instructions. We have to organize and make ourselves safe in a different way. But it has to come from the ground up.
Yeah, there's
it's never going to come from the top down.
Yeah, There's a fierce insistence on our capacity to choose in what you... You wrote your dissertation at Oxford on narrative techniques. How did you master your own unique narrative voice? Did your dissertation play a role in forming your own voice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I read some very good critics, and I had very good teachers at Oxford. And they helped me to see that books were kind of like...
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
In the search for solutions, we must not make the problem worse. It is vital to stay true to the bedrock of international law. It is essential to avoid any form of ethnic cleansing.
The UN Secretary General and other world leaders have condemned President Trump's call for the United States to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population. We'll speak to the Palestinian-American analyst Omar Badar, and then Peter Beinart, author of the new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning.
When I look at what's happened to Gaza, where a state that speaks in the name of the Jewish people, using American weapons with the support of the organized American Jewish community, has destroyed an entire society, and now elements of that American Jewish community are supporting the American president in a call for mass ethnic cleansing. It seems to me that something has gone fundamentally wrong in Jewish public discourse.
Then, as protests continue across the United States over President Trump and Elon Musk's attempts to dismantle the federal government, we'll look at the administration's attacks on the Department of Education.
Let's call President Trump's plan to abolish the Department of Education exactly what it is, an extremist power grab to dismantle public schools and enforce ideological conformity.
We'll speak to Seattle educator Jesse Hagopian, author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests took place in states across the United States Wednesday as President Trump, Elon Musk, and their associates intensified their attempts to dismantle a fast-growing number of government agencies. Thousands rallied on Capitol Hill to demand Congress protect federal agencies. This is Francisco Bencosme, former China policy lead at USAID.
Let's be clear, they're dismantling USAID. They shut down the doors. They brought down banners. They put thousands of people on leave. This is not a reform. This is an attack. And USAID is just the beginning. It's USAID Now, it's the Department of Education next, and it's attack our entire democratic government system.
Wired reports employees of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have received orders to pause all international engagements amidst concerns the scientific agency could also soon face mass firings and have its mission throttled, including its work on developing wind energy. Meanwhile, workers of color at the Health and Human Services Department fear they could be directly targeted after their names and photos were published on a website called DEI Watchlist, created by the American Accountability Foundation. The list of workers' claims their so-called offenses include working on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives and using pronouns in their bios. Democratic Congress members Judy Chu and Gwen Moore confronted House Speaker Mike Johnson Wednesday, showing up at his office during his meeting with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to demand answers on Elon Musk's team gaining access to the Treasury Department's payment system. The lawmakers say Johnson hid Scott Bessent from them. In the Senate, Hawaii Democrat Brian Schatz led an overnight filibuster against the confirmation of Project 2025 architect Russell Vogt to head the Office of Management and Budget.
All of us, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, the media,
which is so damn casual.